Hi, and welcome once again to the Development Finance and CDC podcast. I'm Jack Aldane, the editor of Development Finance.
And I'm Rob Cumber from CDC.
In this episode, we're looking at the potential of technology in helping improve the lives of people living in developing countries. It's a topic that's come to prominence recently with the adoption of technologies such as mobile money and off-grid solar systems, which are both used by hundreds of millions of people. In these areas, innovative businesses have entered the market and have introduced products that have helped people and aided development.
So can these successes be replicated in other sectors? Well, in this podcast, we hear from companies in a variety of industries who are all using technology to reach customers and provide services to help them and create jobs. Over the course of the episode, we'll hear from an education provider, a company selling clean cooking gas, and a firm which connects people with services.
But we also want to understand whether there are any limitations to the role technology can play in development. So later, we speak to an academic who isn't sure whether tech is quite the silver bullet it is often made out to be.
Be part of the development community that's interested and invested in using blockchain. Really have to do a much better job at providing evidence of where it works and where it doesn't.
First, though, Rob spoke to Fausto Marsigo, the Chief Technology Officer of Paygo Energy. Paygo is a startup which provides low-cost, clean cooking gas to people in Kenya.
We are a technology startup focusing on building smart metering solutions for domestic gas applications. And we're trying to help people transition from cooking with charcoal and kerosene to cooking with gas, specifically LPG, which can be bottled and is sold everywhere in the world.
So Fausto, tell us about your customers. Who are they?
Our customers that we've targeted are typically those who are, for a number of reasons, priced out of accessing gas for cooking. We saw in Kenya that the majority of people, around 80%, still cook with charcoal and kerosene. And they're not able to access gas. They're not able to buy gas cylinders because of two things. One is the upfront cost. So a gas cylinder, when you purchase it for the first time, you have to pay a deposit and then you have to buy all the gas inside. And that usually costs you around £40. And on top of that, then you have to buy an appliance, which might be another £20. So when you're earning around $2 to $5 a day, it's very difficult to have that kind of cash flow. The other problem is when your cylinder does run out, you have to refill the entire thing. And that in Kenya would cost you maybe £20 or £30 to refill. So most people don't have that cash flow. And what tends to happen is they'll cook with charcoal and kerosene because these are fuels you can buy in very small amounts. You can buy a little Coke bottle full of kerosene for about 50p, and you can buy a tin of charcoal that will last you one day for 50p as well. So what we've done is we tried to find a way to sell 50p worth of gas, and we do that using a smart meter. So our smart meter allows customers to use mobile money on their phone and to purchase as little as 50p worth of gas. We think our product's important because up until now, the traditional approach to helping people access gas has been either huge government subsidies to make cylinders cheaper, to make gas cheaper, and to try and get people moving away from charcoal and kerosene that way, or from the gas companies that have been making smaller and smaller cylinders to try and match people's cash flows. The issues with making smaller and smaller cylinders is that there's only so small you can go before your capex is just too much for refilling and manufacturing those cylinders. And even the smallest cylinders we have here, which are 1 kg, still end up being pretty expensive.
That was Fausto Marsigo from Paygo Energy speaking to us there. And now I'll hand you back to Jack, who spoke to Adam Grunwald, the CEO of another Kenyan tech company. This one's called Link, and basically what it does is connect service providers, such as maintenance people or cleaners, with customers.
We call ourselves a career platform, right? Just like LinkedIn is a career platform, right? Our guiding question was, what is LinkedIn for the linked out? What does LinkedIn look like for a plumber or a nanny or a housekeeper? which Linkin is not suitable for.
Adam, tell us about the developmental challenge that Link seeks to resolve as an online service platform.
In Kenya now, about 83% of the working population in Kenya works the informal sector. That means that they don't have waged or salaried employment. So they're operating in this gig economy. Maybe one day they're working on a farm. Another day, maybe they're doing some kind of handyman work or plumbing work or whatever else. Maybe another day they're selling fruits or vegetables. This represents a challenge for several reasons. One, it is very, very hard in the informal sector for people to find consistent work. And so I think that's a huge challenge on the side of the workers, right? And then there's also a problem on the side of the employers, which is really difficult to find quality service providers when someone does not have work. There's a very strong incentive for them to say, yeah, I'm a plumber, I'm a carpenter, I'm a baker, I'll watch your kids, like whatever it takes, right? The research that we did when we began was that about 50% of engagement between households and informal sector workers go badly.
Are there any alarming trends in digital financing products in countries within Africa that you can share with us?
There are now something like 200 different microloan providers within that are accessible within Nairobi. It is good that people have access to capital because a lot of research shows that access to capital can help businesses grow and catalyze economies and help people that otherwise might not have that access. But there's also quite a lot of research that says, you know, like microcredit is at best a net neutral sort of offering, right? Maybe actually it is not helping. There are becoming less and less and less regulations or intention around these sorts of microloan products. And again, you can see a situation where when there's hundreds of different microloan providers that are willing to give loans with very small amounts of information, a person could essentially just take a string of different loans from different providers to pay back the previous loan, et cetera, for a very prolonged period of time. So I think that there's a lot of risk in this sector that maybe need to be watched. Building a successful digital intervention requires an enormous amount of user experience research. If we were to build just a digital product without a very heavy operational footprint on the ground, the digital product that we would be building would probably not serve this market very effectively. And I think that a lot of times digital products that maybe are made outside of the market and launched within the market suffer that problem.
Our next guest is Adesua Ifedi. Adesua is the Vice President for Policy at Bridge. Bridge is an education provider that uses technology to develop and disseminate lesson plans and support to teachers who deliver classes with the help of tablet computers.
The key challenge with Bridge is that we have observed that the scale of education problem is growing continuously in the continent where we're working. And the only way to address this kind of a solution, it's a challenge rather, is to create solutions that can be scaled effectively so that quality education can be accessed by children all over the continent. What Bridge does is focus on using technology to support teachers and support administrators so that they can deliver the necessary education to children in these countries where we work in. And we do that at a price point that is affordable to both government and also parents as well.
So Adesua, tell us a bit more about how the technology works.
Let's start from this. What is the challenge and what are the problems that are plaguing the education sector in Africa? There are three key issues that you would see when you deal with education, all of them around how the teacher is able to deliver effectively in the classroom. The first key problem is that the content knowledge. Many teachers are not trained on the content in which they have to disseminate in classrooms. So many of them need a lot of support and help to deliver the right content that will allow children to learn. The second thing is the ability to support teachers and to ensure that they are in the classroom and they are teaching and that what ought to happen for quality education to deliver is happening. And the third piece is to support the administrators who are supporting education with the right data that they need to make the decisions they have to make every day to deliver quality education. So what Bridge does is leverage technology in these three areas. First area is that we deliver content to our teachers in the classroom using the teacher tablet. And the second level is that these tablets also assist in supporting or monitoring the teaching activity. So we also support the quality assurance process by using digital methods. Before now, if you go to do a quality assurance in a school, you'll have to manually collate the data and it doesn't get back to the administrators on time. They cannot make decisions with that data.
I suppose one issue might be, how are teachers able to develop their own careers if these lessons are being planned for them centrally?
So I would always like to talk about this, and I find it very interesting. And when I make this analogy, if you go to every profession today in the world, you go to see the best surgeon in the world. No matter how experienced that surgeon is, he's going to consult his tablet or his computer to collate what the best practice in his industry is before he tells you what he's going to do. He's not going to rely on only what he was taught and only what he knows today, but he's going to have the opportunity to consult with best practice. Now, the teacher, unfortunately, has never had that opportunity. The only thing that has changed in the teaching profession is that the same teacher is still in front of the classroom, but he either has a blackboard or a whiteboard, a chalk or a marker. For education to reach all of the children in Africa that requires it, teachers have to be supported by content knowledge to ensure that these teachers themselves can tap into best practice.
Now, to get a view on the potential limitations of technology in supporting development, Jack spoke to Michael Pisa from the Center for Global Development. Michael recently wrote a paper which looks at the example of blockchain and assesses some of the challenges it needs to overcome in the context of development. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with what blockchain is, you aren't alone, so don't worry. We tried to explain it here succinctly. It's essentially a large publicly available database. There's no central location to the information that's stored there, and because it exists simultaneously in millions of places, it makes it nearly impossible to hack or to alter. Its potential then for the development sector is that it enhances trust, so it could mean faster international payments, better transparency when it comes to disbursements of money, and more secure digital infrastructure. But, as Michael will go on to say, we may need to proceed with a bit of caution.
Michael, how far do you believe digitization can solve the inefficiencies of economies where people struggle to get by on the lowest incomes currently on record?
I think my broader views on technology and development are largely optimistic. But I think, you know, I think one of the reasons we're seeing kind of a new wave of interest, I think mobile money, you can say it was narrowly successful in the first round, but in Kenya, and I think now increasingly in Tanzania and Bangladesh and other countries, mobile money is creating real change. And so I'm not skeptical at all about what like mobile telephones can do. A lot of this was driven by private sector and the development community played catch up. And another kind of technology which I think is going to make fundamental change is the increasing use of digital ID. These are kind of fundamental game, I hate the word game changing, but I think it's not an overstatement to say it really changes the paradigm and how government services can be provided, makes them much more efficient.
You wrote not so long ago about your skepticism on the potential of blockchain technology to have any material impact on raising living standards in the poorest countries. Where does that skepticism come from?
So my view on the kind of the excitement around blockchain is it's often kind of based on this fundamentally misguided view of what the technology can do. You know, the idea that blockchain can work as a substitute for trust only really holds in instances where you're talking about purely digital assets that you want to move on the blockchain, right? Anytime you care about, you know, tying a token to something in the real world, you have to be really concerned about how that interface is being done, and you have to trust actors in the real world. You have to trust humans to do things. So it doesn't really substitute for trust as much as it might shift the people that you need to trust. And I kind of went in the paper, I go into detail on the land registry case, which is the most obvious, I think, but was one of the cases that, you know, the development community was most excited about in the beginning. And that case, the idea that, you know, countries could use blockchain as a land registry, as a platform for land registry, and then leapfrog to the institutional level of more developed countries and starting from a very low baseline. And the argument is that, you know, blockchain is simply a database in the end, and it's garbage in, garbage out. You have to have the processes in place so that you trust the original creation of the documents and the uploading those documents to the database. Because if you put a bad document in the blockchain, it doesn't change the fact that it's a bad document. The part of the development community that's interested and invested in using this technology really have to do a much better job at providing evidence of where it works and where it doesn't. To date, this conversation's kind of been dominated by a small handful of startups that will announce that they've had successful pilot projects. But then when I've had conversations with these folks and I've asked them, okay, well, by what metrics are you measuring success? They really struggle to provide any metrics. We're going to need some kind of community level learning on what works and what doesn't using this technology. And right now we're not getting any kind of evidence base to build that knowledge off of.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Development Finance and CDC podcast. Hopefully it's given you a bit of insight into how companies are using technology in developing countries, as well as perhaps some of the limitations it may have.
We'll be back with another episode very soon, but in the meantime, you can stay up to date with our news on Twitter. We're at DevFinanceNews and at CDC Group.